Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Erica. Today, Hudson Mohawk's magazine, Brandon Miller, interviews members of Associated Universities Incorporated.
Then, part two of Corinne's interview with Troy mayoral incumbent Patrick Madden.
And later on, part two of Alexis' conversation with civil rights lawyer Marlon Bowden.
After that, this week's segment of Women in STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics.
Finally, Willie Terry interviews African-American poet, writer, commentator, activist, and educator Nikki Giovanni, and here are some headlines.
The Times Union reported that on Monday, there was an increased police presence at several Albany and Troy schools after both districts received unspecified threats on Sunday night. Students and staff at Albany High School and the district's middle schools, as well as Troy High School and Troy Middle School, will see additional officers.
Governor Cuomo's on Saturday signed legislation prohibiting the use of elephants in entertainment acts. The Elephant Protection Act, which takes effect in 2 years, bars the practice from circuses, carnivals, parades, trade shows, and more. The law will not apply to zoos or wildlife sanctuaries.
New York state lawmakers held a hearing on Monday on recycling amid China's decision to restrict scrap imports. The halt on China's imports of waste paper and plastic has disrupted U.S. recycling programs. The hearing examined New York's recycling markets and effectiveness of municipal recycling planning. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
First up today, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's correspondent Branda Miller interviews Yasmin Catriccio and Tim Spuck from Associated Universities, Inc. about nonprofit STEM education and public engagement. They visited the sanctuary as part of the process for a National Science Foundation grant.
We're here and honored to invite our two guests from Washington, D.C., who are part of AUI, Associated Universities, Inc., Yasmin Catriccio and Tim Spuck. And first, if you could just tell us a little bit about AUI and the experiences and expertise that brought you here today.
Yeah, so AUI is a nonprofit that specializes in the management of large STEM facilities for the U.S. federal government. And so currently we manage places like the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, the VLA out in New Mexico, if you've ever watched the movie Contact, the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia, which is the world's largest fully steerable radio telescope. And then in collaboration with a couple other international organizations, we manage the ALMA Telescope in northern Chile. And so what brought us here today is that we've been beginning new initiatives in STEM education. And so we are hopefully working on a project that will involve you folks to explore the use of networks to expand interest in STEM careers for underrepresented minorities.
Yasmin, how did you end up doing this kind of work with nonprofit STEM education?
Wow, that's a long story. But I'm just going to say that I just moved to the country. I came here in April this year, and I'm enjoying the Department of Education and Public Outreach next, working with Tim. So I'm supporting the programs that are running for education and STEM and learning for communities, for underrepresented communities.
And where are you coming from? Where are you from?
I'm from Chile.
Wonderful.
I'm from the south of Chile, so Santiago is the capital, which is kind of in the middle, and I am 5 hours driving from Santiago to the south of Chile.
And is that where you learned about STEM education? And also, and now you're coming here and connecting, but also for those listening in our radio audience who do not mm-hmm. even know what STEM education is, what is STEM? How do you understand it? Why is it important?
Well, I didn't learn or know about STEM when I was in the university in Chile, or even when I was working. But then I get to know Tim because they're running a program in Chile that they bring people related to astronomy, to education and science to the observatories in Chile. And they do that. They've been doing that program for 5 years. So last year, they did an open spot for a Chilean teacher, and I ran for that, and I got it. And on that program, I learned about STEM. And for me, STEM is, it is an integrated way to bring together science, engineering, technology, mathematics, and even arts, all together to work and to go for goals. For example, an observatory is a STEM, it's a STEM place, because we don't have just astronomers there. We have engineers, we have mechanics, we have even reporters, we have people for different files, and all of them work together to go for the goals and for what they're working for.
Really? And NSF, National Science Foundation, offers funding for research, innovative education in STEM. Tim, what experience do you have with NSF, and what are some of the innovative projects that are coming out of that and some of the possibilities for us?
Well, I mean, NSF, of course, is the National Science Foundation, and it's the major federal agency that provides funding for research in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, as well as education. And so they are always doing a lot of great work and supporting a lot of great projects. I can tell you a couple of the projects that we're working on. One of them, of course, is what Yasmin mentioned, which is the Astronomy in Chile Educator Ambassadors Program. And that's one that takes that is actually building a network of astronomy education and outreach professionals here in the U.S. that can help communicate the investment that the U.S. is making in astronomy in Chile today, because astronomy is the best place in the world to look at the sky.
Chile.
I'm sorry, it's Chile. Chile is the best place in the world to look at the night sky, as well as the daytime sky and radio. But also, we're working on another project that is exploring computational thinking in astronomy. Mm-hmm. And also, out of that project, we are developing software that makes astronomy accessible to the blind and visually impaired. And so, you know, NSF funds a wide variety of projects, but what they try to do is fund things that are out there on the cutting edge that have potential for having profound impact in improving the quality of life for others, or for improving our understanding of the universe and answering key questions that humanity has explored for since its beginning.
So you're here in Troy, and is this your first time here, Troy?
Yes, it's mine.
Well, we welcome you. And you came, you connected with Dr. Emily Obuya, who's a chemistry professor at SAGE. You've met with Professor Kathy High from RPI. You've taken a tour of the sanctuary as we're trying to strategize how to move forward to really create meaningful infrastructure for STEM education. What are some of your insights you see as to the potential here in Troy, North Troy especially, and the capital region?
Well, I think especially here at the sanctuary, I've only been here for about an hour and a half or so, did the tour. But I have been thoroughly impressed with all that you do with such little in the way of resources. And I think that that speaks to the passion and the commitment and the dedication of the people that are here. And that is not something that you can buy. It's not something that you can go out and teach somebody. It's either you have it or you don't. And you folks have an incredible foundation and infrastructure of human capital, of people, which is the most critical thing in, to build on moving forward. And so I think it's a matter of continuing to do what you do, build the network, bring the community together. Your brainstorming efforts and how you involve the community in designing the future of the activities that are happening here, I think is a very promising sign. I know sometimes people probably look around and you see buildings closed, but what I see here is just a lot of open minds and open hearts, and I think that that's incredible.
Thank you. And I want to ask you a question, Yasmin. As we wrap up this interview, how is science a critical tool, especially for economically disadvantaged communities, to make change and to grow?
Science is the tool that we need to focus. If we have a community that is running on a poverty, if we have a community that needs to grow, we need to teach them how to do science and how to do integrate science. Because country wants to grow, it needs to invest in science. If economic crisis come, the older professional related to science are more likely to keep their job so they can keep moving forward with their lives and their academic studies. So science is a tool where everybody needs to be pointed right now for the future of our community, for the future of our families.
Thank you. And Tim, last words on your insights about the role of grassroots efforts for science education and how they can function as national models.
Well, I think that grassroots, just like the roots of a tree or any sort of living thing, it's your roots that are your foundation. And if you can build a strong grassroots effort, what it does do is it leads to or it lends itself to long-term sustainability. And so as we explore future models for building programs for the future that last well into the next decade and into future decades, I think that figuring out how to design and develop and maintain grassroots initiatives are critical to the long-term sustainability of any initiative.
Thank you so much, Yasmin and Tim.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you so much, Brenda Miller, for that interview.
In this second of a three-part interview with Troy Mayor Patrick Madden, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey talks to the mayor about the city's economic health and finances, his veto of the city council resolution aimed at protecting immigrant families, and what interview with the mayor would be complete without some discussion of the city pools. Mayor Madden faces challenger Rodney Wilshire in the race for Troy Mayor. The election is Tuesday, November 5th. Tune in for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine for each three-part interview with both mayoral candidates leading up to the election.
Moody's Investor Service gave Troy its top available quality rating, marking the second consecutive year this year that Troy has earned an improved bond rating forecast. Can you explain to our listeners what this actually means? A lot of people aren't familiar
with
Moody's.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's sort of wonky, and people say, oh, that's nice, but so what? What's it mean to me? It actually means a lot. We do a fair amount of borrowing to do projects that are grant-funded, and so it brings the cost of borrowing down. And when I say borrowing for grant-funded projects, if we receive a grant, let's take the seawall as an example. We're rebuilding the seawall, and we received a lot of grant funds for that. But we have to front the money. We have to do the work, and when it's done, we get reimbursed. So we have to have a source of capital. We go to the bond market. We issue what are known as BANs, bond anticipation notes. The cost of that is directly related to what our Moody's rating is. Also, very importantly, it sends the message that we're serious about our finances, that Troy is being responsible about its budget. And so businesses that might want to move in and create jobs, or businesses that might want to expand, or even homeowners for that matter, somebody looking to move into the area, if all they're reading about is Troy's financial woes and a terrible bond rating and the Office of State Comptroller is on our back, they're not going to look at Troy the same way as if they hear the news that, oh, Troy's bond rating is going up, people are paying attention. It's not exciting. It's not sexy stuff. It's not the most fun stuff we do here, but it is critical to building the future. It's critical to attracting home buyers. It's critical to attracting developers and investors who want to invest in our city and create a larger tax base, create more jobs for our residents, et cetera. So it's really important work that underpins everything else.
Speaking about generating revenue in mm-hmm. this city, one of the reasons that the city is hurting for funds for municipal services, for cleaning up the trash and the snow and the roads, which everyone is very mm-hmm. concerned about, as you know, is because we have so many churches and so many universities that are tax exempt. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that your administration can do to get private colleges like RPI and Sage to contribute to the revenue that our city so desperately needs for these services?
Well, they do. Actually, RPI is the largest single taxpayer in the city. Most people don't understand that. There's not anything I can force them to do. That's governed by state law. So rather than trying to be at odds with them, I try to work with them. And there is a foundation, the Troy Redevelopment Foundation, which is an aggregation of St. Peter's Health Partners, Russell Sage College, Emma Willard, and RPI. And they give the city a sizable chunk of money each year. Some of it just goes straight into our general fund, and we decide how it's used. And the balance of it is directed. So we propose certain uses for that funding, and the foundation approves it or suggest something different. But they've been approving everything we've put before them since I've been in office. So they're contributing money toward things like the renovation of the park on 7th and Ingalls. They've contributed money toward the youth program services that we've run with the Boys and Girls Club and the Y. They contribute discretionary funds in a variety of ways that promote things that we want to see done here.
And that are in their interest as well.
Well, sure. I mean, certainly all of the nonprofits are bettered when the city is better. So when there's youth programming, when there's better looking parks, when there's more police, when there's whatever they fund, yes, it helps them, but it also helps the residents of the city. That's important to note. We've seen some increases in that funding over the past couple of years, and I attribute that to the fact that we've worked very hard to impress upon them what the needs of the city are and how they can contribute to making the greater community a better community for them to be in.
So many people are so angry about the pools.
Yes.
And that they never opened this summer.
Yeah.
When it became clear that the pools needed a lot more rehab than you originally thought, why didn't you just tell people that? Don't you think issuing some kind of public progress report could have helped people understand and lessened all the public scolding about this? Why did this have to become a scandal?
Well, first of all, I'm angry as well. I'm angry that the pools were let go for as long as they did. When we discovered the severe deterioration of them in 2016, we did tell everybody what was going on. People didn't believe it. We put the engineering reports on the city website. We put photographs up. We did make that known. I could have immediately turned around and bonded for replacing the pools, and it would have resulted in a very significant tax increase. So we're trying to balance what the taxpayer can afford and the amenities we would like to see in the city. We're trying to live within our means. That's unique in the city of Troy, so people aren't used to that. So instead of doing it in year one when it would have triggered a massive tax increase, what we did is we waited until we could afford to do it without burdening the taxpayer. We have funneled money into other youth programs for the summer. So more kids were served by the Boys and Girls Club's pools this year than in 2016, our first year in office, than the kids who went to the South Troy and Lansingburg pools. And they got swimming lessons, and they got meals, and they had a safe, supervised environment to play in. You know, when we said earlier this year that we would try to have the pools open this year, we knew it was a stretch goal. From the background I come from, we would set stretch goals to motivate people. And we did motivate people. The staff here and the contractors worked very hard to make the South Troy pool a reality this summer. But a whole variety of factors just frustrated that effort. It turned out to be even worse than we thought. It had to be re-engineered, it had to be re-inspected by health department. And then we had, because the economy is so hot, we had trouble getting concrete at the end. Otherwise, we would have had it open for a little bit of the summer. So I guess the message is, in government, you don't set stretch goals, or you don't state them publicly, because people hold you to them. We understood it was a very aggressive schedule, and we said that at the outset, but that all got lost. But people stepped up. You know, when you and I were home this summer on those super hot afternoons sitting in our air conditioning, we had people in that pool welding and, you know, doing very hard work with no shade, working very hard to get this pool open for the kids this summer. It didn't happen, and that's a shame. But it wasn't for lack of trying. They did try. They worked their tails off this summer.
You vetoed a city council resolution that would have established the Families and Communities Together Act, which in shorthand, many believe would establish Troy as a sanctuary city. Yeah. And most people don't even know what that means. Can you explain your veto?
Sure. Basically, it was false advertising. We can't be a sanctuary city in the sense, in the common sense meaning of the word, because we live in a county where the sheriff's department has concomitant jurisdiction over law enforcement matters, and they have an agreement with the federal government whereby they act essentially as ICE agents. So to tell people you can come here and live in sanctuary is not accurate. You're giving people a false sense of security. There are many other ways in which information gets to the federal government, so plate readers, facial recognition. I don't believe we have any facial recognition in the city. Certainly the city of Troy doesn't employ that, but there are other government agencies that might.
That would have been breaking news if we learned that there was facial recognition in Troy.
Yeah, it would have been. We don't do it, but I can't say what other law enforcement agencies might have deployed here or there. So, but there are plate readers. That information gets fed up the chain. We don't have control of where that goes. When you are fingerprinted, that goes into large national databases. We don't have any control of where that goes. If you were to get pulled over and remanded to the Rensselaer County Jail for the evening, pending a hearing in the morning, Rensselaer County would determine what your immigration status is and would deal with you. So in large part, the problem I had was that it creates a sense of security that is not warranted. Secondly, the provisions that were contained within the Sanctuary Resolution Bill are things we already do. We don't ask people what their immigration status is.
And the bill would have prevented
It's because, you know, if you were to walk up to the chief of police in Troy right now and say, I'm an undocumented immigrant, the best he could do is say, well, have a nice day. It is not something that Troy police have jurisdiction over. It is not something we have the time to deal with. We have street level crime that we are fighting, bank robberies that we're trying to solve. That's where our energy is directed.
Do you think that the act would have sent a message to immigrant communities that it's safe to call the police for domestic violence, for example, or child abuse?
I can't tell you. I can't answer that. You know, all I know is that we don't want an underground justice system where people feel they can't come to the police, so they're going to take matters into their own hand. We don't want a system where victims of domestic violence don't feel safe calling the police. But I also don't want to hold out Troy as a sanctuary city when we can't offer that guarantee that we're sanctuary.
And that was Corinne Carey with an interview with Patrick Madden.
For those just tuning in, I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Erica. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Marlon Bowden is a civil rights lawyer at the Legal Aid Society in New York City. Hudson Mohawk's magazine Alexis called her to talk about the modern slavery and her latest novel, Arrows of Fire.
We're speaking now with Marlon Bowden, who is an author and expert on human rights abuses and also a lawyer with the Legal Aid Society in New York City. Marlon, can you give us some of your backstory of your Honduran roots and how you came to be an expert in human rights abuses?
Thank you. So thank you for having me on. I was actually born in Honduras, and I immigrated with my family to the Bronx, New York, when I was 7 years old. So I've been raised here. But I had an older brother. He passed away. He lived in Honduras. He never immigrated with us. And he was a school teacher, and he was also a minister. He was the director of a mission in Honduras that provided healthcare and other resources to the poor people in the area where his church was. So he really exposed me a lot to human rights issues from an early age. And then when I was in college, I used to visit him in Honduras a lot. And he took me one time to the Maya ruins at Copan in Honduras. And he showed me this round stone that had been excavated, and he said that it had been used for human sacrifice to decapitate people. And what he said to me was that one of the main reasons why the Spaniards, Cortez were able to beat Moctezuma in the Mexican Empire was because Moctezuma relied so much on human sacrifice to control his people. So, I think that was just sort of like the genesis of my book, Arrows of Fire. So I wanted to explore that human sacrifice as one of the human rights abuses that contributed to the fall of the Mexican Empire. But also as a lawyer, I handle civil cases that have a criminal component. And one of the criminal cases that I handled in the past is a death penalty case. So I've always maintained that the death penalty is really the same as human sacrifice, and that we still have human sacrifice in this world today. But I also work on other human rights issues, and I work on civil rights cases at the Legal Aid Society. And one of the cases that I worked on was called Davis versus the City of New York and the New York City Housing Authority, and it had to do with unlawful stops, frisks, and arrests in public housing. I think that that case had a nationwide impact on how the police enforce laws in public housing across America.
The Legal Aid Society is the nation's oldest law firm for the poor, and you yourself are an anti-war, anti-slavery, and anti-death penalty activist.
Right.
What are some modern examples of slavery?
Oh, okay, so that is a great question, because we were, or at least I was, taught in school that slavery was over and that it, you know, after the Civil War, there was no more slavery. And actually today, around the globe, there are more enslaved people than at any other time in history, and including right here in the United States. In fact, the United States, it's what's called both a destination and a transit country. So that people are brought here as slaves and often taken to other places from here. So yeah, that's in terms of the human rights issues that, you know, affect people all over the planet today, enslavement is one of them.
Why are human rights issues and much of Latin American history not taught in our schools?
The same reason why African American history and Native American history are not taught in our schools. I don't know about you, but the education that I received was essentially a Eurocentric education. And, you know, all the courses that I took from kindergarten to college to high school, the end of high school, I don't think I was ever taught anything other than about the history of Europeans in Europe and in the United States. It's just really where we are a Eurocentric nation, and we're all supposed to think about Europe as our homeland.
Tell us about your book, Arrows of Fire.
So, Arrows of Fire was, it got a really great review by the Midwest Book Review. And the Midwest Book Review said that it is exceptionally entertaining. One reason why I was really pleased to get that review is that earlier drafts of the book said that it was too academic. Because it really, I did a significant amount of research, not just in history. In history, because I'm fluent in Spanish, I read primary sources as well as secondary sources. But I also did a lot of research on archaeology, anthropology, and religion. And so Arrows of Fire is told in three first-person points of view. One is Flower, who is a young girl who's kidnapped, who Moctezuma orders his henchmen to kidnap her from her family and to and basically imprison her in this compound where, and this is actually based on fact, that Moctezuma's people would either capture warriors or kidnap people and force them to essentially be trained to impersonate gods or goddesses in these human sacrifice ceremonies. So Flower is a wholly fictional character, but she is based on all of this significant research and based on fact that young girls were trained to be these deity impersonators, but the night before they were sacrificed, they actually had to have sex with either Moctezuma or with a nobleman. Then the other two first-person point of view voices were Moctezuma, and the third one was Cortez. So you have the two native people, one who is obviously Moctezuma, powerful, wealthy, et cetera, well-educated. And then you have a young girl who is a farmer. And you also have, of course, Cortez telling the conquest of Mexico. And on Cortez's side, his story actually, of course, begins in Spain, but also as a conqueror in the Caribbean So there's a lot of background on both sides.
We've been speaking with Marlon Bodden, a lawyer with the Legal Aid Society in New York City and an author. She is the author of Arrows of Fire and The Wedding Gift. If you want to learn some history that you didn't learn in school, I highly recommend that you check it out. And for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
Thank you, Alexis, for another great interview.
That was Sophia Callenheim with Marlon Bodden.
No. Sophia Cahillane interviews Professor Cecilia Levy from the University at Albany about her research and the struggles of being a woman in STEM.
So this is Sophia Cahillane, and I am with Professor Cecilia Levy from University at Albany, where she researches and teaches physics.
Thank you, Sophia, for having me here. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm really excited that you were able to get down to the sanctuary for this. So just to start us off, how did you originally get interested in STEM?
So I'm a little bit of a weird person for this, because I actually knew that I wanted to be something astro since the age I was of 9, for real. So my dad got me a book on astronomy, and I was just hooked, and I said I was going to be an astrophysicist for the rest.
Yeah.
Pretty much for the rest of my life. Turns out I'm not an astrophysicist. I'm an astroparticle physicist, but I'm saying close enough.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but I do want to say though that this is a little, this is really just me and not everyone. I think that there's a lot of weight for students to know exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And I'm the oddball in here, right? You're actually not supposed to know what you're doing when you're 9 years old. And and it's completely fine to explore and do plenty of stuff until you actually find your calling.
Yeah, I get that. I definitely came into school with astrophysics, you know. It's like, it's the thing. And I'm not there right now. So.
Yeah, and it's completely fine to change your mind. In the end, you have to realize your career is for the rest of your life, right? So might as well really make sure that you actually enjoy what you're doing.
Yes. So can you give an overview of kind of what you do with astroparticle physics?
Yep. So like my day-to-day routine, or just more like just the global idea of what astroparticle physics is?
Second one.
Okay, so astroparticle physics is a subset of particle physics. And so astro, because we look at particles from the sky, if you want. And so one of the really big area in astroparticle physics is the search for dark matter. So dark matter is it's an interesting cookie, because it turns out that everything we know, all of the mass of the universe that we can see, is in fact only 5% of the universe. And so there's really 95% that we have no idea what it is, which I always like, because it I feel like it's very humbling. And we totally don't know anything. We think we know a lot, but we really don't. And so out of the 95% that's left, 25% we think is made out of dark matter. So it's a big deal, because you kind of want to know what 25% of the universe is made of.
Yeah.
And the reason that we are looking for it is because we know that our description of physics and of stuff that we see is actually incorrect. It's not incorrect, it's incomplete. And one of the big missing pieces could be explained with theories that predict the existence of dark matter. And what I always say is that dark matter, we don't know what it is. We don't know what it's made of. That's why we call it dark matter, because we don't know. Okay, we know it's some sort of matter and we can't see it, so we stuck the word dark in front of it. But it's like the wind, you know? It's like, how do you know that the wind exists?
Feel it.
Right, you feel it. You look at the leaves, you look at your tree that's moving, right? And that's the same thing with dark matter. So we see dark matter through its effects on other stuff, okay? And so that's how we know it's there. And so once you know that it's there, then you have theories that tell you what should it be, right? What is it going to be made of? And so we theorize that it's made of at least one particle, maybe more likely a lot more than one particle. And so we're trying to detect these particles.
So kind of hard, I would say.
Yeah.
It's taken a while, right? And
yeah, it's a, it's so it's actually interesting because it's a very fast moving field, but at the same time, we haven't found anything. And the reason is because it's extremely hard to detect because the reason that it's dark is that it doesn't interact with normal matter. And everything that we discover is because of its interaction with normal matter. So the good thing is that there's no such thing as absolutely no interaction. So it must interact at some very, very, very small level. And so that leaves us to being able to detect very, very, very rare interactions. That's why we haven't found anything. But the good news is that there's still plenty of what we call parameter space, which means like, where do we think it is? And that's available. We don't have the technology yet to go all the way to these levels. So there is still a lot of improvements to be done. But when you see the improvements that have been done in the past 20 years, it's actually been phenomenal. So it is really a fast moving field. Mm-hmm. And I think that there will be at some point in the next, I will say 10 years, that if we still haven't found anything, then in itself, that's going to be a really interesting finding because it's going to change our theories. It's going to change the way we're viewing things. And that's what I always say in physics is that this is, there's no zero null result, yeah. Right? The fact that, you know, it's not there is information in its own. Mm-hmm. And again, here in this case, it's really hard to wrap your mind around it because you're dealing with the universe, right? So really, you can say whatever because there's so little that we know, once again.
Yeah. Well, that's super interesting. We can't get, you know, too much farther into that. But I noticed on your bio, because I read that, that you teach a lot of the core physics classes at your school. Do you see this as kind of a place where you can actually, like, encourage and push more women into the physics field? Have you ever encountered that kind of situation?
So actually, I created at Albany a Society of Women in Physics because it's a complex situation. So I think that once we have women that have already taken the step of being in the undergrad classes, that's because they've decided that they want a degree in physics. Most of them will finish their undergrad, but a lot of them will not go into grad school.
Yeah, I've seen some stuff about that.
Yeah, and the problem is, because physics is a male-dominated area, there's a lot of discrimination, there is a lot of sexism, there's a lot of implicit bias. And don't get me wrong, it's getting better. But it's not going to get better until more women are in there. And the problem is, at some point, you don't want to go into a line of work where you know that you're going to have to fight twice as hard to get the same thing. And the hard truth is that that's what it is in physics right now. And there was actually a statistic that came out last year from the American Physical Society, where at QIP, the conference for undergraduate women in physics, mm-hmm. They asked about 500 undergrads if they had ever felt any sort of discrimination or harassment as a physics major, and 74% of them said yes. So wow. That tells you the amount, the problem there.
Yeah.
And it's something that we need to fix. And so that's why I think that people like me that have somehow, I don't know why, managed, okay, we ought to create the Society of Physics, of Women in Physics, where it's not to just say, oh, look at what happened to me, is to say, I know you're gonna meet problems like this in your everyday life, and I want you to have a place, you can have a person that you can come and talk to about anything, somebody that's gonna, that you can relate to, somebody say, you know what, I can see myself there 10 years from now.
Yeah, I found that a lot with the women physics group that I'm a part of, that we just like support each other in that way, and it's really helpful,
right?
Everyday life kind of deal,
right? And even to the idea of that sometimes, you know, you're gonna have something that's gonna happen on one day. And it's so nice to be able to just, you know, go on a Slack, on a chat channel or something and just say, hey, girls, guess what just happened to me, you know? Yeah. And then have, oh, well, maybe this is how you should deal with this situation. You know, have a support group, really. The other thing is that I think that there's a lot of things that women do that hurt ourselves. in the way we present ourselves, in the way that we hold ourselves at a standard that is so much higher than any man. And we just do that. And then the thing is that then, for example, something that women are always going to apologize. You start saying something and you say, sorry, but I do it all the time. I hate it. We can't do that. Why are we apologizing? What we're saying is absolutely right.
Exactly.
You think a guy would be apologizing? And in the core classes that I teach, to go back to your question, that's what I see a lot, is the girls are going to apologize for asking a question. They are not going to dare ask a question. Or even in their test, if they don't know, they don't write anything. The guys, some of them like give me drawings. Like they expect that they're gonna get like 50% of the points because they can draw.
Yeah.
The drawings that have nothing to do with the thing, like smiley faces and stuff like this. Girls would never do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I really want to, you know, try to convey and say, I know this is going to hinder you. Don't do this, you know. Be confident,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. And so really I want to, I feel it's important to have women empower women.
Yeah, so that was incredible. You just answered like all my other questions. but just like one last thing, because we're running out of time. What kind of message do you want to share with young girls, besides the people who are already kind of in the field, but those who are looking at starting something in STEM or physics specifically?
Is STEM difficult? Yes. Is it incredibly difficult? Yes. Is it going to be super challenging? Yes. Is it worth it? Absolutely. And don't let anybody tell you that you can't do it. You gotta go for it. And you know, you will have people that tell you, you sure you don't just, you know, want to stop there in your career? No, go for the world, go for the moon. You can do it.
Yeah,
we can all do it. And we need more women to just take that step and say, you know what? I'm going to be the next astronaut. I'm going to be the next professor. I'm going whatever, right? We need that. So be confident, believe in yourself.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me again.
If you want to learn more about this series, check out Sophia Cahalane's People Power page on the Sanctuary's website. Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry stopped by a book signing ceremony on Thursday, October 10th at SUNY Albany Writer Institute, where he spoke briefly with the great African-American poet, writer, commentator, activist, and educator, Nikki Giovanni. For the last segment this evening, you'll hear his interview with her along with some of her writing and poetry.
I'm getting to be an old woman, and I think like most old women, you have to reflect at some point. I wrote a book called Gemini, sort of to bring people up to date, at least on what I think I am, which is not quite, I'm sure, the whole truth. It never is. No reason I should be any different. I got my fantasies. So I wanted to read a part of the essay Gemini from the book Gemini, trying to deal with us. But if black men ever would decide to define a black man in black terms, I think they would have different expectations of us as women. I went to the opening of an African exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum and noticed only about a dozen black men in the crowd of at least 200 people. And I thought to myself, how odd, no black men. Then I looked at the exhibit piece by piece and began to think I understood something. There was a beautiful door from the Congo. And looking at that door, I saw a man, a woman, several children in the yard, and this white man saying, your door is an excellent example of the Kashana people's art, and I must take it back to Amsterdam. And this beautiful African, barefoot, with perhaps an earring in his left ear, replies, but this door is the door to my house, and it is not for sale. And the woman, sensing something, stops the grinding of grain and begins gathering the children around her, while the white man goes on with, I must have the door. The museum needs it, and I can make 50 dinars on it. And the African rises to his full height on his long, lithe legs, tribal markings dancing slightly on his face, eyes clear and hard, saying, my family needs this door. It is mine. My father left it to me as his father did him. You may not have it. It is not for sale. And the cracker turns in a rage to leave. Then two, perhaps 3 days later, the missionary comes up saying, my son, your door is needed in a great country far away from here. You will be blessed by our Heavenly Father if you give your door to the merchant. And this magnificent African, stooping by his doorway, playing with one of his children, shakes his head. I would be cursed by my ancestors. Go now, go away, and leave us in peace. Then in the night, the soldiers come with the guns. The African responds with a spear. The fire acts from the barrel. The woman screams. The children scatter, asking, what is the matter? The man is stretched out in a pool of dark, murky liquid, and the door is taken down, hoisted upon the shoulders of the black mercenaries, walked to the sea, and freighted back to Amsterdam, so that it can be borrowed by the United States of America to show how the people in Kashana lived in 1582. And I begin to understand why so few black men had come, because it was not a door at all, but dead ancestors murdered in their homes that they would see. Not a statue from Nigeria, but a raped woman, a slit throat, a burned village. And even as I saw that, I knew I would never understand the reality of being a black man. Men grow beards to protect the throat, have hair on their chest to protect the heart, have afros to cushion the head blows. And these things become aesthetically acceptable, if not preferable, but they always have their groundings in survival. My man and I can walk down the street together, and if some guy says something out of the way to me, it's an insult. To him, it could be his life. I can walk away from words and gestures and still be a woman. He cannot and still be a man. So little of a black man's existence relies on his acts. His women, mother, sister, lovers control his life, and generally so irresponsibly that it can be frightening. And sometimes black women aren't very nice, for a lot of reasons. And sometimes we use our power against him, for a lot of reasons. And I think some of the hostility is real and must be related to as such. We're angry, and so are they, but it's only when we admit it that we can get anywhere. I don't think a woman cares where she walks if you'll let her walk with you. And I don't think a man cares that a woman talks if she'll talk to him. And if we really understand, we are born men and women, and it's our choice whether or not we stay that way, I think a lot will change.
Nikki Giovanni, reading from her book, Gemini.
All right, yeah, this is Willie Terry, and I'm here with one of the great African-American poets, Nikki Giovanni. How you doing, Nikki?
How you doing? It's wonderful to be here in Albany.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, welcome to Albany.
Well, thank you, and I know the difference between Albany and Albany.
So just tell us what you've been doing and what projects you've been working on.
Well, I have a book that will be out in the fall, and I'm excited about it. It's called Make Me Rain. And for those of us who are jazz fans, they know that's an old jazz, and it's a riff sort of on that. And I'm, again, it's just poetry, not just, I shouldn't say it like that, but it's poetry. And I have a book, a children's book called A Library, that I'm doing with my good friend Kwame Alexander. Mm-hmm. And Kwame's publishing house is now, because it's called Versify, Change the World One Word at a Time. And so we're going to do that, and those two will be out in the fall. And then, you know, just go on writing and see what we come up with. So, yeah.
Now, I know you're not just a poet, but you've been an activist, too.
Yeah.
So what message were you trying to bring out tonight?
Well, one is that you really must get rid of Donald Trump. That, as I always say, if Hitler married Satan, they would have Donald Trump. And we have to recognize that it's evil. It's not that Donald Trump doesn't understand things. It's Donald Trump is greedy and evil. It's a bad combination. And we have to vote. Because no matter what anybody thinks about voting, as long as I remember, and we should all know, Fannie Lou Hamer. And Fannie Lou went to Atlantic City and fought with Lyndon Johnson and lost that fight because Lyndon offered her two seats for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. But when the bus went back, she turned it down. And when the bus went back to Mississippi, they took her off the bus and really just incredible, just beat and beat and beat her. And I said, as long as there's a breath, as long as I can do anything, I'm going to vote. As much as it doesn't matter who, I'm not trying to say none of that. I'm not trying to say who to vote for. I'm just going to say I'm going to vote. And I think it's so important that black people, and especially the younger generation, I think it's so important that they let their voices be heard. If they don't like anybody that's on the ticket, there's always an empty line there. Write your own name in. Write your mama's name in. But don't let them get away with thinking you won't vote.
Now, I know, like I said, I know you was an actor, but I know you're a poet. Could you just give me a sample of some of your poetry?
Oh, no, not at this hour of the night, Willie. I love you, but it's all I can do to stand here. But thank you very much.
All right. Yeah. All right. And just one last question, Nikki. So are you retired or are you still teaching?
No, I teach. I'm teaching writing for children's literature because I'm trying to, again, I'm amazed at how few black Americans particularly understand the spirituals. They don't know the spirituals. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to show that the spirituals are the basis for a lot of the tales. But the folk tales, the old European folk tales, and the spirituals have so much in common because the same people, The only difference between the one and the other is the color of their skin. But it's the same people. The serfs were trying to teach their children like we were trying to teach ours. And once we can get the serfs, once we can get poor whites to understand they have a whole lot more in common with poor blacks than they do rich white people, the world will change for the better.
All right. Thank you, Lee. That's a great Nikki Giovanni.
Thank you.
I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I am a gazelle. So swift, you can't catch me. For a birthday present when he was 3, I gave my son, Hannibal, an elephant. He gave me Rome for Mother's Day. My strength flows ever on. My son Noah built Newark, and I stood proudly at the helm as we sailed on a soft summer day. I turned myself into myself and was Jesus, Menantone, my loving name. All praises, I am the one who would save. I sowed diamonds in my backyard. My bowels deliver uranium. The filings from my fingernails are semi-precious jewels. On a trip north, I caught a cold and blew my nose, giving oil to the Arab world. I am so hip, even my errors are correct. I sailed west to reach east and had to round off the earth as I went. The hair from my head thinned and gold was laid across 3 continents. I am so perfect, so divine, so ethereal, so surreal. I cannot be comprehended except by my permission. I mean, I can fly like a bird in the sky.
Ego Tripping, a poem by the great Nikki Giovanni.
And that was Willie Terry with Nikki Giovanni.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Chris Kelly.
And I'm Erica. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or to stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.